You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 182. Today's episode is all about bicycling in New Orleans. The last show was fun and free or nearly free things to do in the city, and of course bicycling falls into that. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. I think you'll really enjoy it. Before we jump in, let me talk about the people that make this show possible. Support comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection, the city's premier history museum located at 520 Royal Street in the heart of the French Quarter. Check out their online publication called First Draft. It's a combination blog and online exhibition space that's really underrated. They've done a lot with it. They created it when COVID started, but they've continued it and continue to refine it. You can find it at hnoc.org/firstdraft. Their current temporary exhibit began on April 28th in 2023, and it's about the women's right to vote. It's titled Yet She Is Advancing, New Orleans Women and the Right to Vote, 1878 to 1970. The 19th Amendment, of course, granted American women the right to vote in 1920, but Louisiana's laws effectively disenfranchised black women. As many white women began going to the polls and increasing their political participation, African American women had to continue to fight for access to the ballot. From paying poll taxes to organizing voter registration drives, black women challenged their status as second-class citizens up to and through the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. The exhibit tells that decades-long story through objects, images, documents, and interactive displays, as well as through the words of New Orleans women who for nearly 100 years persisted in their struggle. As always, the Historic New Orleans Collection is free. It again continues somehow to fly under the radar, but it shouldn't be missed. It's a great free museum. There's a ton of resources there. And in fact, we're going to do an upcoming episode about this particular exhibit. So again, hnoc.org/visit to plan your trip. The most frequent questions I get are about moving to New Orleans. And if you're ready to make that move, you probably need a good realtor. That's where Liz Wood comes in. Let Liz and her team over at Liz Wood Realty help you find the right place. They can help whether you plan to rent or purchase. Look, New Orleans is a terrific city, and we're going to get into this, I think, today too, but choosing the neighborhood that's the best fit for you can be overwhelming. Liz makes that process fun and easy. Reach out to her at lizwoodrealty.com and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. Several members of our community, and by several I mean dozens at this point, have done just that, worked with Liz, found their new homes, whether they're renting or buying, and they've been really happy. You will be too. The other thing that sets Liz apart is what she does after she helps you find a home. She's really great at building community. She hosts a lot of events, she keeps in touch with her buyers or renters, and she helps you get connected with people in the area. So when you're ready to make New Orleans your home, reach out to Liz. While you're working with Liz, you're probably going to need to secure financing, and that's where our sponsor Tommy Manzella over at Gulf Coast Mortgage comes in. He's really great at helping you get everything in place. We did that on a refinance a couple years ago, and it was as smooth as could be. And then we went through the same process when we were considering purchasing a new home, and it was just as easy. So, you know, that can be really overwhelming. And again, like Liz, Tommy and his team just make that process really easy. We'll put a link over in the show notes at beyondbourbonst.com/182. And then, kind of a different tack, I want to talk about Two Chicks Walking Tours. Longtime listeners probably remember the crew over at Two Chicks. They operate intentionally small public walks, so the city allows tour groups of up to 28 people, and you'll see that frequently if you wander through the Garden District. But Christine Miller and her team over at Two Chicks limit the size to 14 people. And if they only have one person sign up, they won't cancel that tour. They'll still have it. So you end up with an intimate to extremely small group, and that really makes for a better opportunity in my experience. They also do private curated walks, so they'll do a group from 1 to 200 people, and you can work with Christine to kind of talk ahead of time about what you like to see and what part of the city and what you're interested in, whether it's architecture or history or whatever it might be, and they can curate a really great tour for you. The team is led by mostly females. Again, Christine Miller is the owner, but most of their tour guides are females, including someone who came to New Orleans, got connected to Christine through the podcast, has become a good friend of ours, happens to live in the area where the three of us that are going to talk today lives, and is now a tour guide. But they do have a single rooster strutting around as well, so you might run into him on your visit. So find out more at twochickswalkingtours.com, and as always, we'll put a link in the show notes. Now, with that out of the way, let's get on to today's topic, bicycling in New Orleans. At various times in my own life, I've ridden a bicycle as my primary means of transportation, both in New Orleans and elsewhere. I've also been a competitive triathlete and a cyclist, both while living here and in other places. But today, I'm interested in exploring what the scene looks like in terms of bike lanes, safety, advocacy, coming here as a tourist and wanting to get out and explore the city on a bike, all of those things. So to help me, I have a couple guests. First up is Aline Laspina. I hope I'm saying that right.
Laspina.
Laspina.
Very close.
Laspina. I have to work on my Spanish. From Bike Easy New Orleans. We're also joined by Chris Parker from an organization called Bike Uneasy New Orleans.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So first up, well, thanks, Aline and Chris, for coming on the show. Welcome. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you for coming and inviting us.
Same. Doing pretty well today.
Good. I'm happy to have you guys here. As I mentioned, what I want to do is really get into the bike scene, the situation, the challenges, the successes here in the city. But first, let's get a little bit of information about each of you personally, as well as your organizations. And Aline, let's start with you.
Okay, thank you. My name is Aline Laspina, as Mark mentioned earlier. I am the executive director at Bike Easy here in New Orleans. We are a nonprofit that advocates for easy, safe, and fun biking for everyone in greater New Orleans. Bike Easy was born 20 years ago by a group of, you know, bike enthusiasts just meeting at a bar on the second floor of Avenue Pub. And they put together the Metro Bicycle Coalition that then turned into Bike Easy. So yeah, we're turning 20 this year, which is really exciting. There's always a lot of work to do. My involvement with the organization began, I want to say, 9 years ago when I was Googling, is there a bike share in New Orleans? Because I was going to visit New Orleans and I don't drive. My main means of transportation is biking or mass transit or walking. So I did a Google search and I stumbled upon the Bike Easy blog and I signed up for their newsletter. So they were in my radar by the time I actually moved to New Orleans. And at the time I was looking for work and I decided to see if Bike Easy was hiring. And even though they were not hiring, one of the programs we offer is LCI certification, so League Cycling Instructor. So teaching folks how to teach bike safety. Hmm. And I was like, well, I know how to ride a bike. I like bikes. I have the time to devote to these. It's a free certification. So great timing. I did the smart biking class. I did the LCI certification less than a month later. And then I started teaching bike safety with Bike Easy. Then I'm also a graphic designer. All my degrees are in fine arts, in illustration. So I brought those skills in. So I did a little volunteer work for Bike Easy for a few years and then became their program and operations manager, then their deputy director, acting ED, and now executive director. So much more involved with them for the last 7 years since I moved here permanently. And, you know, even though I was familiar with the organization before I started working with them, once I started working in the organization, I realized how much more we were doing. Hmm. So, you know, the goal is always try to get as many resources out for folks and, you know how to access them, et cetera. So very passionate about what I do. I feel very fortunate. I love the bike community. I've been involved with the social rights since I moved here as well. It's pretty much how I've met everyone in the city. And I think it's, you know, from living before in New York and San Francisco, my favorite city to bike in has been New Orleans. Hmm. And I think in part is because it's tainted by that kind of strong sense of community that I think makes this place so special. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a little bit of overall how I got here.
That's great. Thanks. Chris, how about you?
I'm from here. I grew up and I started riding from mid-city to my parents' house in the River Bend in fourth grade in the 90s, which wasn't always the safest choice, but I had gotten tired of not waiting for the bus. I started running or being an admin for Bike Uneasy in 2018 after the death of Frank Fisher and the incident on Esplanade. And it's just been a lot of me doing a lot of reading, design guides, everything else, and trying to give resources to people who are members of the community that we represent, access to data and then access to the contact information for relevant officials and whatnot.
Sure. And so what is the mission of Bike Uneasy?
Its mission is to argue for vulnerable road users, not necessarily just cyclists, but also pedestrian safety. You've got some people who are very strong advocates for additional like yield signage for pedestrian crosswalks. You've got some people who might scofflaw a little bit and go restripe bike lanes because they feel the city is taking too long. But the primary mission is to give a constructive outlet and resource to those who are frustrated by the city's progress or lack of progress, depending right. on how things are going at a moment, and try to facilitate connecting that person's frustration to the person that it needs to be connected to.
Yeah, and I think that's really important, particularly here in New Orleans. When I first learned about Bike Uneasy, I sort of see it almost as a lobbying group, but that's probably not entirely fair, but a way to help funnel in frustrations, ideas, constructive criticism, because the city does have efforts and has had efforts for a while. But as one person who is bicycling around the city, it's very hard to know how to connect that, how to share an idea or voice a criticism or a comment and get that into wherever in the city government. And that may make a difference.
I mean, I guess the concise way to say you could actually define as kind of like a resource broker. We're here to facilitate giving people in the community resources to contact people like Aline for bike safety classes or contacting people in traffic engineering or 311 because something has been run over, like the stop light button on the greenway.
Right, sure. And I want to get into as we go, and you mentioned Frank Fisher and Esplanade, and that's something that I want to talk about specifically when we get there. Let's first start with some kind of the landscape of bicycling in New Orleans, both sort of the positive and the negative and the changes that you guys have seen. And I'll open it up to either one of you wants to go first.
I'll just mention, you know, right before Katrina, the city only had around 11 miles of protected bike network or low stress bike network. And we have over, I think, 130 now. In the last few years, there was a huge effort to do a rapid expansion of the network. There was some money plugged in to our organization to help advocate, organize community groups, etc. And there was a bikeway blueprint that was created. And, you know, it's like how everything kind of happens. The timing, like, is what creates kind of the need sometimes. And, you know, this is when the Esplanade crash happened, unfortunately. But that made it very relevant for a lot of folks. It was a very sensitive issue. Like, we need more and safer streets for, you know, everybody that's moving around that. And at the time, the city council was a very different city council than what we have today. So I think one of the things that happened is that we had all these great plans. And I think this is one of the problems with the city is that we are really good at coming up with plans and kind of a process and a map. But when it comes to implementation, we are so behind. So we were able to put at least 32 miles of our ambitious 75-mile goal. But it's like really kind of coming into a halt. And I think one of the issues that we're having a lot right now is that there's no consistent maintenance of the current infrastructure. So as an advocate, it's always harder to advocate for more if we, you know, if people keep complaining like there's debris on the lanes, like it's not restriped. You don't know where you're supposed to go.
Right.
And like bringing back Esplanade again, where the crash happened recently on Jazz Fest is an area that recently got restriped. So it's, I don't know. I think there needs to be a change of behavior for everyone that's using the road.
One of the big problems with places like Esplanade where the recent crash happened are also every time our city infrastructure is done well, it breaks down where it crosses state jurisdiction. We recently had the protected bike lane installed on Elysian Fields, and people are like, well, why doesn't it go further up Elysian Fields? And it's like, because at St. Claude, it becomes a state road, and the state just didn't want to work with the city on it.
I didn't know that. I didn't realize that that's why it stops where it stops. So you guys have already mentioned a couple of times in passing Esplanade. So let's fill in people who are listening and wondering about that. Let's talk about briefly both the initial incident with Frank Fisher on Esplanade, and then also just coming off of Jazz Fest just in the last 2 weeks, so that people have kind of an understanding of the history of that.
Well, Frank Fisher was actually a cyclist hit right before the Esplanade incident on Carrollton Avenue. He was rear-ended in because he had to veer to the edge of the bike lane, and there was a garbage truck that turned and came and wasn't looking, and the obstructed bike lane forcing him into traffic, and the garbage truck not paying attention, and it didn't go well.
Right.
After that, you had the Chitante Tony, the drunk driver who plowed through multiple cyclists, killing two, Sheree Wall and
David.
And this was at Jazz Fest. And
that was following Endymion.
In
2018.
Right.
And then we had Kathleen, who I believe everyone calls Kat, who was riding home from Esplanade, and she was hit as she crossed Claiborne Avenue on Esplanade. And watching that video was kind of gut-wrenching because she goes out of frame. You hear a tink noise of metal being impacted. And a few seconds later, about 90 feet from where she would have been, you just see a bike fall vertically in scene, which is...
Yeah, pretty gruesome. Yeah, and, you know, both of those areas, Carrollton Avenue as well as Esplanade, Orleans Avenue, those are all high-traffic areas, but also high bike traffic and pedestrian traffic areas. And then when you add in special events, you mentioned Endymion, the Mardi Gras parade. That was a horrific drunk driving accident. But then you get these incidents along Esplanade, not only coming out of Jazz Fest, but in general, because it's a beautiful avenue. It's big enough to accommodate both cyclists and cars. But we continue to have these problems. We continue to run into these situations.
I mean, one of the problems on Esplanade is that as traffic engineers, the people who design streets want a certain level of consistency as a street goes down. And for much of Esplanade, it's not actually wide enough for a protected bike lane with the requisite buffering you would need so that you can get in and out of the car safely and also not door the cyclist into the sidewalk. And so we kind of put paint on the road and called it good enough and just did that because they didn't want to change from, oh, well, we have enough room here, we don't have enough room here. Mm-hmm. And while I can understand the reasoning for that, I still wonder if there aren't other options that could make that corridor safer, because one thing we do run into is where it is wide enough, you will see drivers try to cut around traffic using the bike lane.
Yeah.
That it winds up being wide the entire route because a driver doesn't have anything physically next to them because there's a bike lane. And so they accelerate and they speed. And I look at some of the redone commercial areas like Oak Street, Uptown, where we have curb extensions and curb bulb outs where every intersection narrows. And I can't help but wonder, could we do some sort of curb extension just across the bike lane and do a curb stop like we have at Broad and Tulane or up by Fountain Blue in Nashville where where the bike lane comes up onto the neutral ground for a second. But just bring that curb extension all the way up to bottleneck the intersection and keep cars from speeding down recklessly.
Right, because what we're talking about in all of those areas you just described are areas where it is really easy for someone driving a vehicle to not think about the fact that there might be somebody else there. Either the road changes or it hasn't changed and all of a sudden they swing out to make a turn, for instance, right? That intersection you talk about on Fountain Blue is actually really pretty innovative in the city. I don't know of another one that does it quite that way, except some of the Littlefeet Greenway does, where you cross a neutral ground. And they've really, I think, done a good job in that spot to try to make it better. But it's not as good as it could be.
Yeah,
it's a little overgrown at the moment.
Yeah.
So Park and Parkways could do us a favor and trim the hedges.
Yes, if anybody's listening from Park and Parkways, because that is a heavily bicycled path.
Yes.
Not only for commuters, but you also see one of the things I'll ask you about later is about tour groups. So that's a scenic area, a place that a lot of people go through. I also see weekend cyclists in packs riding. And that spot is both terrific and also problematic because there's a lot of vehicular traffic that cuts through there as well.
You're thinking Nashville and Fountain Blue.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, it's both, it's attractive to cyclists because it's wide and it's a good way to kind of cut across the city. And that also makes it desirable for motorists as well, right? But there's a lot going on there with the way the turns are set up for traffic. But then also, you're right, that little jog that cyclists have to make is helpful, but it could use a little more awareness. And when it's not kept up, when the parks and recreation aren't up on cutting the grass or the bushes there, any of those things become really dangerous for cyclists.
Yeah. And I think you bring up two things, especially in that area, like something we like to remind folks, intersections always increase the variables. There's going to be more traffic. There's more things. So you have to like be really aware, and that's right. Responsibility for the person walking, for the person biking, or for the person driving. And then the other thing I was going to mention is that area is critical because of the connection. And I think when I think about the network in the city, it feels very disconnected, and yes. How it was built, it was very meal piece. And knowing that there's not enough funds to maybe expand the network the way we wanted, I think it's about shifting people's mentality and educating them on like, this is a connector, this is a long-term plan, making suggestions on better routes, etc. Even, you know, going to festivals, reminding folks, this means there's more traffic. This means there's more people walking to festivals, to drive festivals. And I think one thing that's missing in the city a lot is this mentality of we're sharing the road with folks. Like 1 in 5 households do not have access to vehicles. Hmm. And a lot of people don't think like that. Right. They're like, everybody drives a car. Not everybody drives a car. Not everybody can afford having a car. So I think that shift in behavior is, it takes a while, but I think that's why like work, like what we do, it's important to continue to do it consistently, because at some point there'll be a shift.
Sure.
One of the things we have been doing as an organization is we teach this class called People-Friendly Driving. It is targeted to drivers. We used to do it mostly for, you know, Uber or like Apple Bus or the city sightseeing folks. We try, like during the pandemic, we opened to do it to anybody who wanted to take the class. And we actually took a portion of the class that's specifically infrastructure and created a class just on that. Because a lot of drivers in the city maybe haven't been to driving school in decades.
Right.
And suddenly they have all these new infrastructure and they don't know how to navigate around it. So it is our responsibility to teach folks and educate them. Like Tulane Avenue, it's very confusing for some folks because the bike lane is on the left. AP Turo, which is one of the projects that's coming up, is going to have, because they resurfaced that area and they did a bunch of studies, the bike lane is going to go alongside the neutral ground. Apart from the West Bank, we don't have that infrastructure here in the city. So it's going to be a little bit of a shift of mentality because people don't know how to navigate around that. And one of the reasons that decision was made was because there's so many driveways alongside AP Turo. Mm-hmm. So, you know, community outreach and like communicating with folks and making sure that from the time that you tell them what's going to happen and you break ground, that, you know, people have selective memory. So sure. Having good timing is important.
Yeah. And there was, you know, there was this massive plan. And certainly, so I'm someone that grew up in the city, grew up riding my bike in the city at a very young age in Gentilly, rode all over, even after I had a car, still used it as my primary transportation, the bicycle. I was away for 15 years, came back to a city I came back in 2010, 2011. So right when the sort of plan had come out, and then very quickly you saw a patchwork. You saw things happening, but it then stalled, and it's not really interconnected, right? So we're trying to retrofit a city, obviously, for this, as opposed to some other cities that maybe as they grew and planned, they thought about bicyclers as well as pedestrians. Our city isn't that way, so trying to fit it in. And then a lot of the places we're talking about, I think again about Esplanade, there's a lot going on there, right? So if you're riding or driving down, you know, we're a city where the blocks are very short, so you have to pay attention very often. We don't have long, it's not like being in a suburban area where maybe a block is really long, it's really short. You have people trying to make turns across our neutral ground, some of which are small, some of which are not. So on Esplanade, you know, the neutral ground is really just a couple feet wide. So it's not as much protected area for both the cyclist or the pedestrian or the person in a car or vehicle. You know, I also think about, like you said, you mentioned Tulane Avenue and just some of it. It just seems like there's not a one size fits all for the city, right? And that's challenging, I think, for both bicyclists, but also in fairness for people who are driving. So that program is great. How else do you guys go about trying to advocate and trying to get the word out about safety and what that means and what opportunities there are to learn?
So we do a lot of classes. They're all free. We have them. Most of them are free. They're through a grant through the Louisiana Highway Safety Commission. That's how we do all our education programming. This year, we actually have been working on a project with the RTA for years. We finally finished it, but it's an orientation video specific for their operators. Hmm. And they paid us to do it, which was great. And it's 400 operators between bus, streetcar, ferry, because there's bike facilities there, and the ADA buses. Mm-hmm. For us, it's like, how do we fix the problem in the long run? How do we educate folks? So those are some of the kind of things. Also, offering bike valet at a lot of festivals, mm-hmm. to, you know, remind folks this is a great way to get to places, because like less cars on the road. So right now we're doing Wednesday at the Square for the rest of the month. I think the last one is May 24th, because they had to reschedule a day. So just kind of giving those resources to folks. And then we also do a ton of work with youth. Mm. One project I'm really excited about is Living School in New Orleans East. I feel like a lot of times the New Orleans East just kind of gets forgotten.
Sure.
But we started a partnership with them last year, and we go once a week for a bike club. So teaching kids to be more comfortable riding longer distances outside of the school. Mm-hmm. So they become more comfortable riding in traffic. So by the time they're adults, it's like
second nature. Yeah.
Yeah, correct. And then another day of the week, we go and teach them bike mechanic skills because they're opening their first community bike shop in New Orleans, which gets me really excited because there's a lot of service pockets in the city. Like after the pandemic, huge bike boom, more people on bikes, mm-hmm. on the streets, but there's not enough bike shops. We don't have enough fix-it stations in the city. People don't have the skills necessarily to fix their own bikes sometimes. So we try to teach those skills as well. And sorry, one more thing that popped to mind.
No, this is great.
So last year we had some issues with bike lane removals in the West Bank, and you know the whole thing that happened in that. And as an organization,
Chris has something to say about that as well.
We were wondering, like, how can we activate the bike community better? And in my head, it's like, we need to listen to them. We need to listen to their needs. And we have to create spaces where people can come and talk to each other. So this year, we started this series called Bike Talks. So think about tech talks, but
okay.
about bike stuff. And we did our first one a couple months ago on community bike shops. We're having one on June 29th. It's going to be about e-bikes. Chris, I hadn't told you about that. I just confirmed that this week, Charlie Thomas from Bikeless is going to be our moderator. But we are going to take this opportunity to teach folks about e-bikes. Like at Bike Valet, we've noticing like an increase in e-bikes, mm-hmm. that we're parking, but not every bike shop in the city knows how to fix e-bikes. So there's definitely an opportunity there for growth. At Lobby Day for the Bike Summit earlier this year in April, I was in DC advocating for a legislation towards e-bikes, which would be a rebate that you get or a tax credit you get. Mm. And it could happen at point of sale. So there's a lot of things happening as we're moving forward in, you know, technology with bikes, but kind of trying to create those spaces as well where people can come in, they can learn, and they can also network with each other. And because that's where we can hear what they need.
Sure. And I want to get Chris's the reason that caused his sigh. But where do people find out about all the classes that you guys offer?
On our website. So if you go like under events, all the events should be listed there. We also post them on Facebook. So if you follow us on social media, either Facebook or on Instagram, if you click on our profile, there's a link there that usually lists all our events as well.
And we'll put in the show notes over at beyondbourbonst.com, we'll put links to your organizations and to some of these things that we're talking about in our discussion so that people have that. But there was a noticeable sigh when Aline mentioned the West Bank and some removal of bike lanes. So why don't you jump in there, Chris? First, maybe tell people what happened.
Well, the West Bank did not need the same amount of, was being worked on substantially quickly early in the bike lane implementation, mm-hmm. phase. Mm-hmm. And it moved quickly because they didn't have as much subsurface infrastructure work to be done. They weren't tied up in the FEMA funding. And there's a whole lot of the people who objected to bike lanes spewed this into weird conspiracies about the former executive of Bike Easy trying to make this huge money grab by monopolizing the bike lanes for Blue Bikes, which doesn't operate on the West Bank over there. Right. So it's a lot of really pretzeled thoughts that they really reached for. But it happened fairly quickly, and then it ran into some, it ran right into the pandemic. And so I actually object with a lot of people who are like, well, the outreach wasn't done well. And like, well, the city reached out pretty well to the neighborhood association heads. They did some community rides. I know Bike Easy did some flyering over there. I was able to find, because one of the residents who didn't like the bike lane said it was done in secret and challenged me to show where it had been advertised. I found 11 different examples of it being discussed in the news before the completion of it. And it, but one of the things that happened when the pandemic came in is it stalled. And I think Aline mentioned earlier that people sometimes have a short or selective memory. Some people saw bicycle and tuned out of the conversation right there, so they didn't see what was coming. Some people may have argued about it or said, well, this isn't enough engagement or whatnot earlier in the process, but then they discounted that further at when it stalled and took a longer period. Because they're like, well, it was all talk back then. Now suddenly you're putting everything down all at once, and that's one of the things about bike lanes. They're, unless they're physically poured concrete, they do go down quickly.
Sure.
The irony being that they, the people that objected to a lot of that bike lane changed it from, well, we're not against bike lanes, we're against this design. The city reduced the number of bowler or the plastic bollards used as delineation, and then used some concrete pour-ins at the intersections to accommodate complaints by a good portion of the residents. And then, of course, the group shifted their tone to, no, no, this isn't what we wanted. We wanted it moved to, and what they kept saying was a bike lane, but what they meant was a sharrow or a shared lane, which I guess a lot of drivers don't realize isn't the same as a bike lane. It's not a dedicated space. It's a space where I frequently am riding on a street with a sharrow and have still had cars get up on my rear wheel and just honk.
Right.
And it's just, it's not what was there. And then once it was down after the first year, we started seeing data. And one of the residents in Algiers, who's a civil engineer, collated the available data, and he sent me it and sent me the links to it, and I went and looked at it again and couldn't find any errors with his estimates. But it was basically showing that if you looked at the safety snapshot the city had from before the road was redone and compared it to the, you know, time from which the bike lane was last adjusted, it showed a 65% reduction in total injuries on MacArthur, and that didn't play any role in the public discussion of its removal, which I found immensely frustrating, because drivers are like, well, there are no there's no one on bike. And I'm like, there doesn't need to be to justify this. Look at the number of people who aren't being hurt now as a result of the traffic calming effect of this design change.
Sure.
And I'm trying to figure out, I've been trying to figure out since then, one, how not to lose consensus, because that's what happened there. We they had talked, they had reached out, a lot of the neighbors were on board, and then with the pandemic and everything, and not maintaining that communication, that support eroded, and then everyone's like, well, the support was never there, and I was like, that's rewriting history. The support was built up, but just as you can build up support, you can lose support if you don't maintain it.
Right, and, and COVID didn't help, right, where you had this time gap where things stood still. And then it came back, and you know, you mentioned, you've mentioned data several times, and I saw, I don't know if it's on the Bike Uneasy Facebook group, but very recently, in the last week or two, a new map was generated or was put forward.
So it's the transportation safety dashboard that was presented at the transportation committee meeting at City Council on Monday, and this was put together between the health department and DPW. And what's really great about it is, I mean, I'm a visual learner, so if you go on it, what's great is that it really gives you a good picture of the last several years in terms of injuries for people walking, biking, in ATVs, in cars, but it's also split by district. And so you can start seeing a pattern. Tricky things when you're reading this kind of data is that they're always almost a year behind because it's all the data that's from the police department gets
sure.
to the centralized database, and then they had to like clean it and dissect it because sometimes after investigations and stuff, and then it gets plugged in onto the map. Something else to bear in mind is that the points on the map of injuries are not necessarily the exact location because of privacy issues. Mm-hmm. At least that's what they were mentioning when they were presenting, but it does show you a heat map or a overall picture of where we are at, which it's not a good place.
Right.
But because of that, then you can show that there's a need. And mm-hmm. I can definitely see, and I don't know if Chris agrees with me, but I'm starting to see a shift at City Council where I think folks are becoming more aware that this is important. Safer streets for everyone that's on the street is important. Unfortunately, like that Esplanade crash that recently happened, plus what happened, I-610 and I-10 with the gentleman who died in the crash also involving a bike. It's like all these things added together. It's like, okay, we need to do something about these. And that the other thing they presented that same day is extending the school zones. Currently, school zones go from K through 7, but they're proposing extending it K through 12. And they data, again, going back to data doesn't lie. They did show that a lot of the injuries that they compare the injuries that are happening in school zones during school time versus K through 12, like 8 through 12, and the injuries there are higher, obviously. So sure, there's definitely sense. A case for that. And one of the council members was like, well, could we also extend these to youth organizations, which would take more legislation, but at least people are starting to think more, how can we fix this in the longer term for everyone?
So I was excited to see I tend to be visual too. And I liked it in that, yes, it shows not a good picture, but it does in a fairly concise way show a picture. And both as a, you know, if you're trying to advocate, then I think it's important to get that data out. But also as a cyclist, it's useful to look at that. If you're local, if you're listening to this and you're local in New Orleans, it's worth looking at that those are the areas you need to pay even more attention, right? Now, obviously, in a perfect world, we also get motorists to pay more attention in those areas. But we can start with the community that's engaged and obviously interested in bicycle and pedestrian safety. And I spent a lot of time looking at where I ride relative to that map and saying, well, gosh, this is an area where I need to pay even more attention because unfortunately there are more problems in a given area than in others. And so I think it serves two roles, right? There's education for the cyclist. There's also education in terms of what I'll call lobbying and sort of trying to get the government to change and the council to listen. And so I think in both ways, we'll make sure that we get a link to that and put it in the show notes because I think it's really a useful tool. I see it as a positive that it was created, if nothing else, much more so than, yes, it doesn't tell a good story, but at least it's a place to focus the discussion, right?
I liked the creation of the heat map because it does tell you places that might need special focus. I do worry a little bit that we're going to continue a pattern of going, well, the problem is over here now, and tracing a specific point, whereas we just did so much road work. And if we took a systemic approach where we went, these are the safer designs, and we should be implementing them everywhere as we make road changes, it would improve safety for everyone, not just, and that's better in my mind than a reactionary approach of going, oh, well, that spot has become a problem. Let's fix it.
Right.
Why not prevent problems from occurring by fixing everything as we do general maintenance?
Right. Yeah. And so I'll just jump in there and say, if you live in New Orleans, then you know there is road work all over the place right now. And so to Chris's point, why not as we're redoing the road, let's think about the whole thing, right? Let's think about bikes. Let's think about pedestrians. Let's think about cars. If you're not from here, then that's one of the things you don't see. But on the one hand, it's positive. There's all these projects going on, but I'm with you that there is a tendency to say, well, this is a problem as opposed to how do we systemically make it a better place, right? A better pathway.
And actually, you gave me this idea, Chris, is, you know, the call to action to folks. Like when Chris and I show up to City Council, like council members and their assistants already recognize us as the bike people. and the tricky thing about that is that they view us as like this small group of passionate advocates. Mm-hmm. But to what Chris said is I do think sometimes people criticize and will complain about the things that are not working. But also people should maybe talk about the things that are working and letting them their council members know and going to neighborhood associations and the neighborhood meetings. Like every city council member does offer, I think it's weekly, they'll have, I think for council member Green, it's in the library on St. Bernard, which is escaping my head right now. What's the name of the library? Alvar? No. It's the one on AP Tour. It's AP Tour in St. Bernard. Yeah. I don't know why that is.
Right, that is where they hold their regular meetings.
But they have somebody that sits there every week where you can just come and talk to them. But
about the neighborhood engagement officers.
Yeah, correct.
And that's not actually the council. That's going to be the mayor's office.
Oh, okay.
But yes, there is someone for every district that has there's a neighborhood engagement office for every district, every council district operated by the mayor's office. And you can reach out to them and they have contact information for the council member and they'll know who the directors of all the departments are. So they're a good person to talk to and get information passed along.
Yeah, so the call to action is really to just be more engaged, but not just when it comes to complaining about something, but actually highlighting something that is working. Because with our policy and design committee, they started doing Safety Sunday cleanups where they go into they clean up a bike lane like with the Gentilly Boulevard under I-610 and probably filled over 50 contractor bags of trash in one morning. And we work with the sanitation department to pick that up, but then we also make observations, put a report, and present it to the city. But we think this is not a long-term solution because it's really the city's responsibility to maintain these. But the reason we do this particular effort is to get people more engaged, to take ownership over the infrastructure, to not just leave it to the advocates. Because what we learned, especially with the West Bank, I call it the West Bank battles, is that it's important that people who are local to the particular areas that are being affected show up to the conversation.
Sure.
In however way that can happen. I mean, one of the flaws in that whole thing is the day they did the final vote, we were there for 6 hours on a weekday. Hmm. Not everybody can.
Right. Can't take off a day of work to go do that.
Yeah. Especially not knowing, well, what time are they actually going to be talking? And, you know, it's like they put a map showing like, oh, these are all the advocates for the bike lanes, and it clearly showed that most of us lived in the East Bank and not in the West Bank, which was very clever, but also, you know, it's tricky because we are representing folks who cannot show up to the conversation. So it's showing up to the conversation, I think, is important.
See, some of the heaviest cycling neighborhoods on the West Bank are poor neighborhoods. You have a lot of cyclists who ride from the cutoff, and everyone goes, well, none of them take MacArthur except all of the ones that do, because MacArthur went pretty much from the cutoff to Winn-Dixie. And then they'll jump on me and be like, well, MacArthur doesn't go to the cutoff. It goes near General Meyer, which is the next straight route to the cutoff. And it's...
Sure. And those are the same people who can't take off time from work to get to an event like a public hearing.
One of the people that was arguing found a data point which said something along the lines of 92% of working age people in New Orleans owned a car, and they argued that argues differently from that. Why is that number so different from 1 in 5? I'm like, households not having car access. I was like, well, but I tried to point out to them that working age people is a very large qualifier. Mm-hmm. People over 65 are considered in past retirement age and not working age. So they're excluded from that number. So there are a lot of older people that don't have cars. And then there are a lot of people that are high school and younger that don't have cars. And so they're having this conversation that ignores everyone south of 18 and everyone over 65. And I'm like, it's convenient that you're cutting out entire chunks of the population to make your number look better.
Sure. So what can people, and you've mentioned it in passing a little bit, Aline, but what can people do that are listening that want to get more involved to be part of the voice? What kind of things can they do? What kind of organizations can they join? How do they support what you guys are doing?
As individuals, it helps to do things like if you see that there's signage missing, there's bollards damage, put those 311 requests in and then like put a star on the email when you receive it or a flag or however you want to keep track of it. And then if you don't get a response in a timely manner, this is a city. Let's say you go, I'm going to check back on this next month. If no one has done anything, email your council person and go, hey, this is a problem. I understand it might take time to fix, but no one has even responded and follow up so that they can get you an answer. Mm-hmm. And that'll put pressure. But the trick to that is that everyone needs to do it consistently. And I know Aline talked about doing bike lane cleanups. There's a group on the West Bank, the Algiers Street Riders, and they do a weekly cleanup, and they'll try to do 311 requests when they see things. Bike Uneasy members have done similar events in the past. One of them was on the Broad Street overpass where they went and picked up a whole bunch of sand that had been spilled from somewhere, and then they went back and forth and they took photos of the missing rollers and sent in 311 requests. I rode down South Carrollton in the River Bend at one point and took photos of every bit of damage there was, and I posted pairs of photos to the group and asked other people if they could duplicate my ticket to get more attention.
Right.
Yeah.
And I will say, I've used 311 both for things related to cycling lanes and other things. And I also always send a copy of that to my councilman. In my case, it's Joe Giarusso. And I will say that they do follow up. They run into some of the same frustrations that things aren't necessarily handled as quickly as possible. But they do seem to, at least in my case, they do seem to follow up. Or if you ping back and say, hey, Joe, I haven't heard anything and it's been a month, you will see instantly a message back to try to pull on that. And I think that's what has to happen, right? Because it also reinforces to the councilman that people, council person, that people care about these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And that sort of community engagement is one of the things that the Bike Uneasy group focuses on trying to get people to do. Because if all you do is say what the negative was and don't try to fix it, it doesn't actually make our situation better.
Right.
And to the 311 request, we have found that when you get 13 people to put in a request about a given event or given issue, it's much more likely to get
noticed,
fixed,
yeah,
than
absolutely.
If one person puts in a ticket.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we've talked a lot about some of the challenges in the city. Let's talk about some of the good things. What are the positives that you see? What are the places, and I'm also now have in mind not only locals, but people coming to visit. What are some of the high points that you would point out of places that are great to ride or things that we seem to be doing well?
Yeah, so one of the great things about biking in this city is that it's flat. The only mountains or inclines you have to ever deal with would be either the Broad Street Ridge or Norman C. Francis. But it is a great city to bike in. If you're not very comfortable riding with traffic, riding through City Park, there's lots of paths, Marconi Drive, the Wisner Trail. It's really a fun place. You can ride all the way to the lake. There's protected bike lanes back there too. So for folks who are maybe visiting and don't want to deal too much with traffic, those are great places. French Quarter gets a little tricky because there's a lot of traffic still there, but you can go to the riverfront for sure. And then there's a lot of social rides. So if you're visiting town, there's pretty much a social ride every single night of the week, depending if you want to go fast, if you want to ride just with women or women-identified folks. There's some where, you know, you could have maybe a drink and get on the bike, which is fine. A lot of people do it, but there's like tons of different group rides you could be part of. So that's a great way to meet locals and to explore the city. And you know, it's really good when you're going as a group because it's a little bit safer.
Sure.
In some ways. And sometimes they'll have a bike that you can rent and they have fun lights, so you're looking cool when you're riding your bike.
How would people find out about those kind of events?
I wish we did have a centralized listing. I think if you just Google Social Ride New Orleans, you'll find it. Like, I'm part of one that happens every single Thursday. We meet at 7, roll out at 8. We usually do 10 miles over a couple hours, do a couple stops. Locations change every single week. We do try to explore every neighborhood. And the Social Ride has been riding for almost 12 years. Check people's Stravas, because sometimes you can follow their own routes for sure. With the social ride, at least when I lead the rides, I save them on our ride spot, so you can actually follow the ride on your phone if you're using the Ride Spot app as well. And Outspoken, it's a show that happens on Tuesdays. Janica van der Molen, it's the host for that, and she usually lists, I don't know if she's doing it lately, but she usually lists all the social rides that are happening. There's rides in the West Bank, correct?
You've got the West Bank Social Riders. You've got NOLA Social Ride, the group that on Thursday. You've got the, what is it, the What are the Monday night bikes?
It's Monday night bikes.
Are the slightly faster paced. There's, I think, a Wednesday morning ride. Is that the...
NorBC. I forgot the name.
That rolls out of City Park.
Yeah.
You've got...
Heat Index Wednesday nights as
you've
well.
You've got Heat Index. You've got One Up Riders. You've...
Loops.
You've got Loops. You've got Get Up and Ride.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
I know I'm forgetting one or two now, right now, but...
No,
Sugar Rush on Fridays.
And then you also have there are bike tours, you know. So I live in the Fountain Blue neighborhood, and I see people come by in the bike tours. I don't know the names of any of them off the top of my head, but, you know, again, it's that idea of riding in a group. If you're feeling a little unsafe or unsure, whether that's because of your skills or you're new to the city or you're visiting, I think that's a great way, too, to explore the city on a bike.
Yeah.
Definitely. Oh, Alger Street Riders.
Oh, yeah.
That's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sure if we sat here, we would just keep rattling out groups.
Well, and the point, though, is that there are a lot of opportunities. And I think that people don't always associate New Orleans and bicycling, but there really are. And the city is relatively small. And so the compactness is sometimes part of the problems we've talked about with you get cars and pedestrians and cyclists all in a very tight space. But it also makes it a pretty neat place as a bike rider. You can go. You were talking at the start of the show, Chris, about riding from one part of the city to another to get to your parents' house. It's pretty easy to cross the city on a bike in terms of time. A lot of times faster than you can in a car, frankly.
I was looking at the estimate for taking the bus from the airport in Kenner to like Dongfeng in New Orleans East. Uh-huh. And then I compared it to using a bike, and Google estimated the bike is faster.
Yeah. I mean, and that's almost as far as you can go in greater New Orleans, right? Without crossing the lake. That's a pretty far distance. And so I think that's a real positive about the city.
Yeah. And I was going to say, if you're visiting and you're more of a road biker, we have the Levee.
Yes.
And you can do an easy... Well, I call it easy. Go early, especially if you come in the summer.
The heat, yes, there's no shade.
Because it can get really hot and there's no trees to cover you of the Mississippi River Trail. But now you can go all the way to Norco and even past Norco and do 50 miles easy going back and forth, or 75 miles. So
soon it's going to be a lot longer than that because they settled the lawsuits in Baton Rouge. So they're continuing the Mississippi River Trail southward. So they'll try and... So they can connect them up.
Which is great. I lived in Northern Virginia for a long time. And one of the things that I really loved is I could go out the back of our condo and get on a series of connecting trails that would go 184 miles in one direction. You know, and so the closest thing we have to that here is the Tammany Trace, the trail on the other side of the river, on the other side of the lake, excuse me. But it's not nearly that far.
No. Yeah. So one of the dream ideas that we've been kind of trying to grow as an organization and with some other local partners is the Louisiana Bootlace Trail Network. And the idea is to create a trail around the lake going all the way to Baton Rouge. And we've had several meetings about these. And right now it's more like idea planting and kind of figuring out why is this important. It gets tricky because it involves a lot of different parishes,
a lot of
different mayors. Yeah. And how different city council works, etc. So we've been trying to work a little bit more cross-regionally.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we're pushing these kind of ideas, it's like easier for people to be like, yeah, I'm totally into that.
Sure.
Like, it's one of the reasons I did Noma to Noma last year is because it's like, if I want to advocate for a trail, I want to experience it myself. And Highway 22 was terrifying.
So mention that. You mentioned in passing, what is that event that you just mentioned?
So it's not happening again, at least this year.
But hopefully it will.
Yeah. So it's basically a ride around the lake, 150 miles in one day. It's an unsupported ride. Over 100 people sign up for it. One of the reasons I sign up is very few women do it, especially Latina women. So I just wanted to kind of be part of that number, kind of experience something new, learn how to ride a road bike, and kind of also got me in touch with the community of, I call it the serious cyclists, you know, the Lycra folks.
Right.
And it was a lonely journey for me because some of these people could just consistently do 18 to 22 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. I could not. So I did most of the ride by myself. It took me, I think, 14 and a half hours. A lot of talking to myself through the whole thing. But it was very interesting because there's something, I think it's like, we talk a lot about sometimes people on bikes in the city are not visible.
Uh-huh.
So for me, it's like, I want to change the way that people see bikes. And there's something really beautiful about as even as you're torturing yourself, just you're the person that's pushing the bike. Like, uh-huh. unless you're pedaling, the bike's not moving. And I don't think anything else can give you that kind of feeling. So to be able to cover such a distance, mm-hmm. just the best sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, and I think it brings attention to the opportunities around the lake, right? The things that there are to do, and that potentially if we could create a path. I mean, I get that that's very complicated, but that would be a real attraction for people that are into cycling. You could see club rides, you could see whether you're fast or slow or whatever, whether it's parts of it or the whole thing. I've lived in other places where it made it relatively easy to have a 100-mile event, and you would get hundreds, if not thousands in some cases, of people doing that, right? Because it just becomes a draw for the community that is interested in cycling.
It's also of note that we've got a lot of bike infrastructure that has actually popped up southeast of us in St. Bernard Parish. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think it would be interesting if we had something that crossed from the North Shore to the South Shore, either some modification to Highway 11, which is unlikely because they just finished doing some renovation work and they'll probably not touch that bridge again for a very long time. They love to neglect it.
Right.
The other option are the smaller bridges by the Wrigley's, which mm-hmm. which have a fairly low traffic. So right. they might be able to set those up where they simply mark the roads and mark it as a bike route and
right.
let it be shared infrastructure with little traffic calming elements to prevent people from doing anything
and
ridiculous.
And that specific route, when they did the work on that, which maybe now is 10 years ago, I don't know, they made it substantially wider. So there is probably more opportunity there to do something. There's space, is what, you know. So I do have a couple questions for you guys. I have Patreon supporters. So those are folks that contribute a little bit of money each month to help me do what I do. And I ask them for questions. So these are kind of, in one case, we've touched it, but I'm going to just throw these at you guys a little randomly. Donald Tatera says, please talk about the NOLA World Naked Bike Ride, the purpose and history. Either one of you want to try to tackle that?
Well, I've frequently been described by my significant others as a never nude, so I'm going to leave this to Aline.
Yeah, I mean, I've participated in the Naked Bike Ride since I moved to the city. And so context is, think about critical mass in other cities. Like in San Francisco, I believe it's the last Friday of the month. Hundreds of people on bikes just take over the street. Why doing it naked in this city is because the most vulnerable, and again, bringing visibility to people on bikes. I think people who come to the World Naked Bike Ride come with very different agendas. But
yes.
In general, the sentiment is like, we want to show we're vulnerable. We want people to notice us. Like if you're walking on the street or you're driving and you suddenly see hundreds of people at all different levels of nudity, you're going to notice them.
Right.
The first few years I used to ride it, I would usually bring my dog and I loved screaming. She always rides naked, you know, but there's something really beautiful about riding in such a gigantic group and making a statement. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people have different, I guess, sentiments or feelings towards nudity. But again, it's as bare as you dare. So if you want to go in a swimsuit, go in a swimsuit.
Right.
I've gotten into the habit of, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, I try to make an honor to ghost bikes. So I usually like dress my bike in white and I have these wings that have the names of people who have died in crashes with the year where it happened and how it happened, if we have the information on that. And then last year, again, because I'm a visual artist, I started embroidering the names onto a white dress, but the idea is to just be a little bit more intentional about the message, plus also volunteer for the body paint as well. Because there's this idea of, you know, as a bike advocate, you want to promote bike safety, but now I can actually use my artistic skill and paint it on folks. And again, people do it for many different reasons, but the whole goal is really to create awareness on people on bikes, for people to notice us. So, you know, it's tricky that you have to do it naked, but...
But it does to the point, right? If that's what gets it in the news or that's what gets people interested in it or recognizing this is a whatever you feel about it, it's guaranteed to draw more attention than 20 people riding by in Lycra on a Saturday afternoon. You know, that's a big population of people using our roads, but it's not going to get a media story. Right.
Correct.
And it's not going to draw people. Some people are drawn to the idea of riding the bike. Some people are drawn to the nudity. Like you said, people have all sorts of reasons, but collectively it forms an impact.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And there's people that just kind of travel to get here to just do that.
Right. Right.
You know, so I highly encourage everyone to participate at whatever level, you know, if you want to be in full bodysuit, feel, you know, just have fun with it.
I liken it to in San Francisco, there's the Beta Breakers foot race, massive, 30,000 people, I think. And there's a significant number of people that run it naked. And there's this shock value to it. And then there are plenty of people, like when I ran it fully clothed in running clothes. But it's a sight one way or the other. And it is an attention getting thing. I think you guys hit this, but Ellison Bolden asks, is there any plan to add more bike lanes in the city? Right now, I only really feel comfortable riding in the parks. And you guys have kind of gotten to that. I think part of this is public awareness and figuring out how do we pick back up from this plan, right?
There are definitely safe routes that are a little more expansive than just the parks. The Greenway was mentioned, and while you need to be careful at some of the crossings, it spans a good section of the city. It goes from the French Quarter all the way to City Park and allows for a lot of riding between the two.
Yeah, if you're a visitor, that's a great, even non-visitor, right? I mean, it's great. It's really nice. They've done a lot of
tree planting.
Yeah, it's pretty, right? You come through and then you can cross really, like you said, from the back of the French Quarter through up to mid-city. And then you can connect into some of these other areas like Bayou St. John and all the way up to the lake.
And riding along Moss Street along Bayou St. John during daytime, at least, is generally fairly pleasant. You occasionally get an obnoxious driver, but not normally speedway drivers.
Yeah. Yeah. The curviness helps that some, right? Yeah. You're following the bayou there.
And that connects you to either the front of City Park or Wisner if you want to ride along the bayou all the way up to the lake.
Yeah. And I was going to say, so in the last year, there were some improvements to current bike infrastructure, not as much new infrastructure, but on the pipeline, we have MLK. Mm-hmm. So just down the street from our office, that should be completed through the summer. And that's going to go from St. Charles all the way to Claiborne. And then hopefully at some point they'll work from Claiborne all the way to Broad. And then AP Tour is also happening. And that's going to be from Broad to St. Bernard. Again, protected bike lanes along the neutral ground. That's a little delay because, of course, once they brought the machines in, there's now a leak. So there's a delay. And we're really going to push for North Miro to be completed. That's been on the back burner forever. But North Miro is going to basically mirror North Galvez, so protected bike lane. Mm-hmm. However, it's going to be on the right side.
So the opposite side.
So the side that we're not used to. So that's because of parking, that's the compromise that they had to come up with. But that's really what's in the pipeline right now. So hopefully next year we can start creating more connections between the networks, people can understand it better. There's some work being done in the East, and then more regionally, Jefferson Parish also has a lot of new work.
And one of the things I do like, unlike many things in the city, you see the improvements happen in the upper class neighborhoods. And while the bike lane project, if we call it that, has been very patchwork, I think, as we've described, what I do like is that it is cutting across neighborhoods. So it is not, in my opinion, just predominantly, say, upper-class neighborhoods. It cuts through, as you mentioned, New Orleans East, all the way to the French Quarter and all over the city. So that, to me, is encouraging for many reasons. One, I think it gets people into other communities. It also serves communities where maybe there are a higher population of people dependent on either walking or being on bicycles. And I think it just brings the city together, you know. For instance, you often see, or whether it's real or perceived, repairs get done in, say, the Garden District, or they get done in Uptown New Orleans. But the bike paths that you're talking about, AP Turo and Galvez and New Orleans East and the stuff in St. Bernard Parish, really cuts socioeconomically, the West Bank, much more than many of the other projects that I see happening in the city. And that, to me, is an encouraging sign.
Yeah, definitely.
One other thing, and this we got to this a little bit. Ashley Bones or Bonus says, I've been to New Orleans and biked a handful of times. Sometimes I've gotten different bike rentals. Sometimes an Airbnb has supplies us with bikes. It's easy because it's so flat. Would you cover safety recommendations? Maybe talk a little bit about helmet requirements, lights on bikes, locking up bikes around town. And then secondly, she says, I really love the new changes with the biking in City Park and Bayou St. John and the lakefront. Is there an area near there where I could rent a bicycle? So I've kind of thrown a lot at you there.
That's so much to say. So, yeah. So one thing that everybody should do when they ride their bikes is we call it the ABC quick check. So check for air, make sure your tires have air, know how to read the PSI on your tire so you don't overpump your tire, don't pump it enough, because what will happen is the city does have a lot of potholes. So if you hit a pothole and your bike's not, or your tire's not pumped enough, you can get a pinch flat and it's a pain in the neck to fix.
The other side is if it's overinflated, it's bouncy and doesn't want to keep traction.
Yes.
Yeah. So know the sweet spot of your bike. So A for air, B for brakes, so make sure your brakes work. C is for cranks, chains, like anything that starts with a C on your bike, you want to make sure that it's in good condition. And again, this goes into like making sure you're riding a bike in good condition. You need to know how to fit it to your body type. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, be predictable when you're on the road, follow the rules of the road, you know, signal so people know where you're going. Eye contact with drivers, huge key thing that I think some people just underestimate the power that it has. And if you don't have a bike, there's tons of rental places in the city, but there's also a bike share system. It's called Blue Bikes, and they have a pedal assist bike. You can do that through the app. And also, if you're not visiting but you live here and you're on Snap, you can get a monthly subscription. I think it's only $4 versus $25. So those are great, and they are slowly plugging more bikes to that particular system. And one of the great things about Blue Bikes, I'm just going to promote them in here, is that it's now operated by a nonprofit as well. Right. And they really make an effort on doing community outreach in different areas. And they've done like little social rides and things like that. But again, if you don't have your own bike, those are easy bikes to adjust your height, and yeah, they're well-maintained. And again, they're pedal assist, so you won't be doing a ton of pedaling. I mean, you will still have to pedal, but you know,
you can cover
more ground. And it's a dockless system, so you know, if you're going to City Park or whatever, it makes it a little easier for you to get around.
Do you guys know, is there a Blue Bike station in City Park?
I think there's one at Bike Cafe du Monde.
Oh, okay.
There's one, and I will mention too that recently Blue Bikes worked with Noma. So actually, if you go to Noma, you get a discount code for Blue Bikes as well.
Oh, if you go to
and
New Orleans,
they do
Museum
a lot of promotions, front. Like you know, when the pandemic was full swing, you could use certain codes to go and get vaccinated for mm-hmm. free, like in the system. And they do a lot of promotions like that. So definitely follow them on social media if you're visiting, because they do have a lot of promos.
Well, and I bring it up because if you were staying, say, downtown, you could take the streetcar to City Park, then you could walk over to Café du Monde, get a Blue Bike from there, and then that opens up not only the whole park to you, but Bayou St. John and the lakefront. And that's one of the improvements in recent years, I think, that bike trail along Bayou St. John, and I guess it now completely goes around City Park, around the old golf courses.
Yeah, that was nice.
That's terrific. I for many years was a marathoner, and we would run that route early in the morning with a group called the 520 Club, and none of that existed. And it was dangerous because you were on the road early in the morning, low light conditions, and now you have this really beautiful to go along the path. I also like the tie into history that's the route that Bienville came into the city through Bayou St. John. So there's some history there. And so if you can hop on a Blue Bike, that's a great way. If you're visiting,
yeah,
you could go to City Park, get a Blue Bike, and then ride as much as you want, really.
And also, if you bring your own bike and you don't want to bike all the way to the lake and then do the trail, you can put your bike on the buses. Our buses are equipped with usually two bike racks a bike rack for two bikes in the front. And then one thing I wanted to mention, because you were talking about the Wisner Trail in the park and how it wasn't as good before and now it's great, the city's currently, or there's a big effort in the cities for a vision master plan for the parks. So if you're a local, look it up, fill out the survey. But the idea is to make our current parks even better.
Yeah.
So if you have feedback of like, this trail could use more lights, like the Marconi Drive is great when it goes into City Park, but at night there's no lights whatsoever.
No.
So also important thing with your bikes, make sure you have working lights. By law in New Orleans, you do have to have a front and back light. And we do bike light giveaway. So if you don't have a bike light, reach out to Bike Easy. Well, make sure you have one. Helmets are required for kids 13 and younger. What's the other? Oh, you need to have a bell or something that, what's the name?
You need a bell or signaling device that cannot be a whistle or a klaxon.
Yes.
So a horn, a bell, people use whistles. It's from that little bit of municipal code is from when police whistles were the common signaling device, and they didn't want you to be confused. And I don't think anyone cares if you use a whistle now.
Right. I think most people would appreciate any kind of noise that helps signal, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that you're there.
Other little bits are, I think at some point they made a modification to the text for the light and they messed up the order for sunset and sundown. So now you're supposed, on municipal code, you're supposed to use your light between sunup and sunset. And I'm like, that's backwards.
Right.
But the state law says to do it right. The state got it right on that one.
But these are all good practices anyway, right?
Yeah.
Wearing a helmet, making sure your bike is in good working order, having lights, having a noise-making device that alerts people, a lock, maybe more than one lock.
Yeah. And I would say, especially if you're visiting town in the French Quarter, there's certain poles where you cannot park. So just be aware of the signage. And then also a huge recommendation for anyone even outside of New Orleans is to register your bike on Bike Index. Mm-hmm. It's a national database. In case something does happen to your bike, what will happen in the city is that bikes get put into a truck, they get taken to Mississippi or to Alabama to be sold. But this is a national database, so you can actually put a call out. And it really will take you 5 minutes. You put your serial number and a picture of your bike.
Right. So as we start to wrap up, any last minute things that we haven't covered that either or both of you would like to talk about?
I mean, I could probably talk about infrastructure I'd like to see here for, in, like we talked about Wisner, and one of the things that really bugs me about the Wisner Trail is that the turnoffs from Wisner to side streets are slip lane designs.
Oh,
and I really wish we would, one, put slightly better, because the bike trail there is done in parallel, I wish it was given priority at crossings, but even without that, I wish we could do raised continuous sidewalk crossings, something that slowed traffic as opposed to having traffic speeding through those turns at 35, 40 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Sure.
You have a similar slip lane at Carrollton and Tulane Avenue when you're going riverbound, or and going if you take the slip lane to go to Airline, you see people whip through that one, and a similar one at St. Claude onto Elysian.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wish, I mean, personally, I wish we could get rid of that kind of slip lane altogether. I think it encourages high-speed turns where you will have conflicts with pedestrians.
Sure.
But maybe if we just left the sidewalk at level and made it a big, wide, soft, but noticeable speed table, people would slow down.
Right, sure. Yeah, but that makes good sense.
Yeah.
I know.
I think the only thing I would add is, you know, we're always looking for new partners. So if you have want more information, let's, you know, always reach out to us, info@bikeeasy.org or bikeeasy.org. Just go to our website, sign up for our newsletters.
And if you come here from somewhere else that has better infrastructure and you have thoughts on it, look up the council person responsible for where you're riding and send them an email and say, hey, I was visiting from here and I think y'all need to work on insert your thoughts.
XYZ, yeah. No, I think those are good points. I you know, councils come and go and they change and their focuses change, but we have to speak up, right? We have to speak up for what we see that's good. I thought that was a good point that you made, but also the things that we want to see improved. Their job is to listen and our job is to speak up, and both of those things have to happen. It can't just be one or the other. I really appreciate it. I think you guys have thrown out a lot of information. I'll collect as much of this as I can and put it in a resources section on the website, which will be over at beyondbourbonst.com/182. Thank you, Elaine and Chris, both for doing this. I really appreciate it. I think this has been a really jam-packed information session. So thanks for that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I feel we could go for hours.
Yeah. And that's a good thing, like that there is so much to talk about. I think that wasn't always the case in this city, and now there is an interest, there's activity, there's lots of ways, as you've both talked about, to be engaged and involved, whether it's to have fun or to be an advocate or to do both. So thank you both again for that. I really appreciate it. I wanted to say thanks again to our sponsors, the Historic New Orleans Collection, Liz Wood Realty, Tommy Manzella, Two Chicks Walking Tours, and our patrons. Find out more about all of those in the show notes. And with that, I'm going to toss it over to my daughters, who, as an aside, are both bike riders, to take us away.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.